Good morning. This has been a really beautiful gathering so far. So we are in the first Sunday of Lent, which is a 40-day season beginning on Ash Wednesday, which ends on Holy Saturday. Lent comes from the Anglo-Saxon word lenten, which actually means spring. Spring is good news, right? The 40 days represent the time that Jesus spent in the wilderness, the story that Shannon read to us this morning, where Jesus was enduring the temptation of Satan and beginning to prepare his ministry. Lent is a season that really helps us to ground ourselves in the story of God. It's an opportunity for us to rehearse the narrative that gives our lives meaning and identity. We retell the same stories again and again because they are defining stories for us. These stories shape who we are and who we see ourselves becoming because of God's saving action then and now. So, welcome to the empty season. A season of fasting, confession, contemplation, sacrifice, and self-denial. As we prepare for the coming of Easter, which is actually a 50-day season in the church calendar, a season of feasting, Lent is perhaps one of the most counter-cultural and spiritually important seasons of the year. And let's get something straight right off the hop. The hunger that we often speak of during this season is not my 3 p.m. craving for a snack to tide me over until dinner. It's not even the intense hunger pangs I feel when it's time for dinner and I didn't have time to eat lunch, which happens several times a week. But then you'd hardly expect me to compare my afternoon hunger pangs with the sort of hunger that we speak of, that we focus on during this season of Lent, a 40-day fast. I doubt many of us, if any, have ever managed a 40-day fast, even if slightly modified. But in Lent, it's a profound hunger that we speak of. Not for food. The kind of hunger we might actually call a holy hunger. The scriptures speak of this hunger in many ways and in many forms. It's a hunger that threatens to lay us low. It's a deep void when we are empty of what we long for most. It's a hunger that is not easily or quickly remedied, at least not usually. Even if you haven't fasted for 40 days, I happen to know that many of us, most, in fact, have at some point in our lives hungered in the way I speak of. There are those amongst us who grieve deeply, having lost a loved one, a spouse, a child, a parent, a sibling, a dear friend. And it's been long enough that other people seem to have moved on and nearly forgotten your grief. But you daily carry with you a painful, aching, searing hunger, a void that for some reason refuses to be filled. There are those among us living with a deep hunger and pain at the ending of an intimate relationship. Life did not unfold the way that you had expected, or in the way that was promised. There are those who experience confusion and even a sort of paralysis because you stand at a life-changing fork in the road. And both choices hold opportunity and both hold loss, and you hunger for peace of mind and for clarity as to what direction you should take. There are those who've been deeply wounded, maybe by a stranger, but more likely a friend or family member. The anger and bitterness has settled deep into your soul, and you long for justice. But it's unlikely that that injustice will ever be acknowledged, much less repaired, and so you just live with the hunger. There are those with a spiritual void, what St. John of the Cross called the dark night of the soul. There's a loss of faith, a loss of hope, a loss of joy in life, which is beyond what you know how to regain or refill. If you identify with any of those, then Lent is the season for you. And even if you don't identify right now, the season of Lent is still for you. Lent is a time for all of us to acknowledge and embrace hunger, emptiness, wilderness, longing, need, and to stay in that state for a time. Lent is kind of an in-between time. In the Christian calendar, Transfiguration Sunday falls on the last Sunday before Lent starts. We celebrated that last week, as Warren taught to us from Luke chapter 9. And then today is the first Sunday in Lent, and in 7 weeks, we will celebrate Good Friday and Easter. And I want to make sure that we're really clear where in this season we are currently located, where on that timeline. We are between Transfiguration and Easter in more ways than one. On the Mount of Transfiguration, Jesus and his disciples had this shimmering mountaintop experience, this encounter with Moses and Elijah, and a voice came from heaven, and a blessing was said on Jesus. And on that mountain, the disciples, and by extension we, get a really clear vision of this close connection between heaven and earth. There's not much that separates them, we're led to assume. In fact, a couple of the disciples try to create a separation. At least that's how I interpret the story. Peter pipes up, "Master, let's put up 3 shelters, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah. Let's institutionalize this moment." Now, he didn't use that word, but I think that's what he meant. He meant, let's take this shimmering experience, this thin, gauze-like curtain that barely separates heaven and earth, that lets the God light shine through so intensely, and let's make a permanent, substantial home for it. So we can always point to that structure and say, see, this is where God is, and this is what God is up to, up here, not down there in the valley. Luke 9 doesn't tell us that Jesus gave Peter a big eye roll, but I like to think he did. What the Bible actually says is Peter did not know what he was saying. In Bible speak, that's an eye roll. So that's the transfiguration. And the resurrection is a little bit like that, in the sense that the separation that we try to maintain between earth and heaven breaks down. It was symbolized, in fact, when at the moment of resurrection, the curtain in the temple was ripped in two. The curtain supposedly separating the holy from the ordinary. Again, a shimmering experience was afforded to the disciples. First, in this case, to the women, and soon after, to the men. God was putting them all on notice. God was saying, I choose to be here in the ordinary, in your human experience of suffering and death. I will make your ordinary the stuff of the holy by being with you in it, by never leaving you, no matter what. Suffering and death don't get the last word. I do. the mountaintop passages of transfiguration and resurrection literally bookend the season we're in currently of Lent. The Mount of Transfiguration right before Lent and the Mount of Olives right after, the central hub of the Passion of Jesus and all the glorious and terrible events that unfolded near it. Lent is perfectly situated, it seems to me, to help us embrace life between the mountains, when there's no shimmering gauze that separates us from the holy, only a deep, dark, and expansive wilderness, a bottomless void, and sheer emptiness. It is when the separation seems most difficult to cross, the most distant, the most unlikely to find fulfillment, that we find ourselves in the season of wilderness. That's Lent. But Lent does not paint a picture of hopelessness or aloneness. The emptiness of Lent is like a spiritual discipline. We choose to enter the fast. We choose to embrace emptiness and wilderness. We choose to name and acknowledge the suffering. And we have the courage to do so because we know, often despite appearances to the contrary, that the space between heaven and earth is in fact a very thin space. That God, in fact, is very close. God is with us in the ordinary, and we can trust God to provide. So with that as the backdrop, let's look at today's gospel reading from Matthew 4 for just a couple minutes, which takes us straight into the void. It's the story of Jesus' three temptations in the wilderness, and this is a test. And by that, I don't mean a pop quiz. I mean that this is a grueling spiritual workout for Jesus. It's a story of Jesus finding out how deep he can go into the hunger and how much he can trust God to provide the feast. Jesus had literally just been baptized by John in the Jordan River. He had just been proclaimed in public by a voice from heaven that he was the Son of God, God's own beloved. And then immediately, it says, the Holy Spirit sent him into the wilderness. Sent. And it's really hard, I think, for us to imagine the depth of suffering, the excruciating physical and emotional and spiritual isolation, that pure emptiness that 40 days all alone in such a barren place must have been for Jesus. In the desert, Jesus' emerging identity was tested. And I imagine it was very difficult. Some in the Christian tradition like to dismiss these temptations as superficial, that Jesus didn't really struggle with them, that they're really only symbolic. My feeling is that Jesus may actually beg to differ. When Jesus was tempted to use his power to turn stones into bread to satisfy his intense physical hunger and emptiness, when Jesus was tempted to make things happen by his own political power and influence rather than to wait for God to move and act, when Jesus was tempted to attract glory and attention to himself and force God's hand to save him on demand, the real underlying temptation in all three of those was to reject deep hunger, to scorn emptiness, to deny being needy, to shun vulnerability, and to take a shortcut to the feast. The real temptation was to disbelieve what he heard at his baptism, to disbelieve the identity that God gave him, to shed his identity, to release himself from this dangerous calling, to forget who he belonged to, and to grab hold of intoxicating power by controlling his own destiny, satisfying his own desires, and using power over others to accomplish his agenda. Don't think for a minute that those weren't real temptations. And don't think for a minute that those same temptations didn't haunt him over and over and over again during his whole ministry on earth, most of all at the very end. We who are called by Christ are in exactly that same position. And the battle that we face within us is to take our lives into our own hands or to entrust our lives to the hands of God. We too are given a name by God. Every one of us, a calling and an identity and a place and a people to whom we belong. We are called God's own children. God literally adopts every one of us into a new community. And we're constantly tempted, like Jesus, to short-circuit the hunger and to go straight to the table. We're tempted to satisfy our own desires on our own timetable. We like to fancy ourselves as self-sufficient. We don't much like hunger, truth be told. We certainly don't like wilderness. We would rather gallivant from mountaintop to mountaintop. Lent is a season that we so desperately need spiritually. It forces us to face up to the lie that we are self-sufficient. Lent shines a light into our sinful shadows and reveals us to be who we truly are. Loved by God, but in need of being redeemed and forgiven and offered grace over and over and over again. The truth is, we aren't self-sufficient. We don't have everything it takes. We actually lack what we truly need. We are people who have to look to God in deep, vulnerable trust. Our struggle is between accepting our emptiness and God's grace, or rejecting our emptiness and taking matters into our own hands. And of course, the world that we live in would have us believe that we belong to ourselves, that by sheer act of will and the power of positive thinking, each of us can become the person we truly want to be. But that's not true. The truth is, we're in desperate need of God. Every breath we take is a gift from our loving Father in heaven. All that we are and all that we have is owed entirely to this lover, creator God. Lent is the ideal time to refocus, to rethink, to repent, and to reorient our lives Godward. This is the season for embracing the unfulfilled hunger and just waiting with it for a while. The various ways that we hunger and trusting God that God is going to provide the feast. Today and every Sunday during Lent, we will openly name, confess, and even embrace the various ways that we hunger. And we will sit with that hunger, but we will also be reminded that we are not alone in it. This week, I was watching the public memorial for Kobe Bryant and his daughter Gigi and the others who perished a month or so ago in a helicopter accident on the way to basketball practice. Staples Center in LA was packed full of celebrities and athletes and fans of Kobe Bryant. Jimmy Kimmel hosted the memorial, and various celebrities and athletes paid tribute. It was a very moving memorial, in my opinion. And some deeply spiritual and beautiful things were said and sung. One truly beautiful moment happened when Jimmy Kimmel talked about an ancient Christian ritual and then invited everyone in the stadium to participate.
Today we're joined by Kobe's teammates and opponents alike, his friends, his family, and his fans, as we try to make sense of what happened to these nine beautiful people who were, by all accounts, so full of life, who left behind parents, friends, co-workers, classmates, siblings, and children. I've been trying to come up with something positive to take away from this, and it was hard because there isn't much, but the best thing I think I was able to come up with is this: gratitude. It seems to me that all we can do is be grateful for the time we had with them and for the time we have left with each other. And that's all. In the Catholic Church, you know, which the Bryant family is part of, at Mass, we share the sign of peace. This is a moment to hug or shake hands with people around you. And it occurred to me that that is something that only seems to happen at church and at sporting events, when perfect strangers who love the same team are suddenly hugging and high-fiving and celebrating together. And so, since we are here today to celebrate, I'd like to invite you right now to take a moment to say hello to the people around you, whether you know them or not, to be grateful for life and for the fact that we are all here together.
Here they are, a stadium full of people enacting a deeply ancient and beautiful Christian tradition and being invited into that. The idea of passing the peace is an important ritual in many Christian traditions, not just Catholicism, but particularly in mainline traditions. And it originates in the scriptures. For instance, in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5, Jesus said, "If you're offering your gift at the altar, and there you remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your offering there before the altar and go. First, be reconciled to your brother or sister, and then come with your offering." Passing the peace began as a way for people in the Christian community to be reconciled to one another before making their offering at the altar. It is for this reason that most churches practice it right before they walk to the communion table to participate in the Eucharist. During the Last Supper, Jesus said in John 14, "Peace I leave with you. My peace I give you." And later he said, "My command is this: love each other as I have loved you." When Jesus himself appeared to the disciples after the resurrection, he greeted them by breathing on them and saying, "Peace be with you," in Luke 24. Passing the peace really brings two ideas together. Just as Jesus shared his peace with us, so we share peace with each other. Sharing peace with one another is an ancient Christian tradition, not only in the words of Jesus in Scripture, but also in the practices of the early church and the church throughout history in the Christian community. Paul the Apostle begins every single one of his letters with the words, "Grace to you and peace." And so grace and peace was the way that Christians greeted one another. It was kind of like their secret handshake. In a hostile world where people are always being pitted against each other, the Christian community greets one another with peace. This morning, we're going to spend a few moments participating in some beautiful ancient rituals together as a community. The first is that I'm going to invite you to pass the peace. Next, I'm going to invite you for a few moments in another ancient Christian tradition, and that is to sit in quiet reflection, meditation, and confession. And finally, I'm going to invite you to this table. The chunk of bread and the cup of juice are just a small taste of the goodness of God.